Welcome to Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. This is the 14th episode of a 20-part series on the history of the Catholic Church. I'm glad you're listening, and I hope that you've been learning an awful lot as we go through. This episode is dealing with the 13th century, the years 1200 to 1300. It seems that at the beginning of every episode, I say, wow, there's an awful lot that happened in this 100 years. And so it is again in this momentous century. The 13th century sees the rise of the Franciscans, the Dominicans, and some notable popes who led the way forward. But again, to give us a little bit of background, a little bit of foundation, we need to go back and just review a little bit what has happened over the previous centuries. Remember, in the 12th century, the popes continued a period of reform. In the 12th century, the popes were drawn largely from the monastic orders, and it was the renewal of the monastic orders which then also helped to renew the church. In the 12th century, the church became much more administratively savvy. As the monasteries had spread all over Europe, so now the Christian faith, the Catholic Church, had spread pretty much all over Europe, and the popes realized that they needed to have legates in each of the countries, they needed to have more canon law, they needed to have more ways of actually organizing the church, so that their power also, therefore, became much more absolute all across Europe. In fact, the popes during the 11th and 12th centuries eventually emerged as the one unifying sort of political as well as spiritual power right across Europe. So, although in the 9th and the 10th centuries we went through such a dark period with popes who were criminals and wicked men, we saw that therefore in the 11th and 12th centuries reform started to come through into the church, and we will see that it continues even more now into the 13th century. So there's 200 or 300 years of reform in the papacy and in the church, which are really a dynamic time when Europe is also moving into the high Middle Ages. Moving out of the Dark Ages for the papacy also meant moving out of the Dark Ages for European civilization. Civilization and all that went with it, with art and learning and architecture and music and education and just jurisprudence and government and politics all began to move into a much higher level of organization and a much grander expression of what we call Christendom, a civilization which spread all across medieval Europe. And remember in the previous episodes, I said how important it was, how important monasticism was to this rise and reform in the church and also rise of European civilization. It was the Benedictine monks who first established the little enclaves of learning, prayer, hard work, compassion, hospitality. And in the Dark Ages, these little enclaves or little oases of civilization kept the light burning when all around seemed to be dark. And it was from that those monasteries that the church was reformed, and we really see European civilization beginning to flourish now in the 13th and then on to the 14th centuries, and in what we call the High Middle Ages. And St. Benedict of Norcia, therefore, is called the patron of Europe because it was those seeds he planted of monasticism and true spirituality which spread across Europe and then became the seedbed for the reform that would follow. Well, so far in the Triumphs and Tragedies, we've been focusing on a fair bit on the papacy, and that is because what happens in the papacy is always intertwined and reflected on what's happening elsewhere in the church and elsewhere in Europe. But to begin today's session on Triumphs and Tragedies, I'd like to go back and just spend a bit more time reviewing the development of the different monastic orders through this same time period, beginning with St. Benedict in the 6th century, so that you can review with me the different orders and how they developed over the years, because it wasn't just a single order of Benedictine monks flourishing all across Europe. The monastic movement, generally speaking, had lots of different expressions. There were the Celtic monks from St. Patrick, even earlier than Benedict, moving east into Europe from Ireland. But also there was the Eastern monks in Greece, in Asia Minor, and also in North Africa. That began the monastic movement, and Benedict is part of that whole movement, and the Benedictine monks are part of that whole movement, a movement which will continue to grow and expand across Europe. So just as a brief review, although the monks begun in the 6th century, of course, due to human nature, they sometimes tended to become overly wealthy and overly complacent, and there was a small brief reform movement in the 9th century, in the beginning of the 9th century, by Benedict of Anian. He was an abbot of the monastery at Anian, and he began to initiate a reform of the Benedictine movement. But it was difficult because each of the Benedictine monasteries was independent. We think of a religious order now with one central headquarters and a central abbot over 3 or 4 or 5 or even 20, 30 monasteries all around the world. But in these early centuries, the monasteries were all independent. They were self-ruling, and therefore it was difficult to organize a reform movement. One monastery might reform itself, but it didn't have any authority over another one to be able to bring about that reform. The real movement of reform began in the monastery of Cluny in Burgundy in central France. And I mentioned this before because a good number of the monks were influential in helping to reform the papacy. And indeed, some of the future popes then came from the Abbey of Cluny. Cluny in Burgundy had a couple of strong abbots who were very reforming abbots. In the 10th century, Bishop Odo and Mayul in 994, and Odilo in the 11th century, the middle of the 11th century. The difference about the what they call the Clunaic reform, or the reform from Cluny, is that different independent monasteries began to put themselves under the rule of Cluny, and Cluny therefore began to develop what we now would recognize as a religious order, with one head monastery or chief monastery, and the abbot of that monastery having oversight for all the other monasteries. So all the other monasteries priories, a priory is like a small branch of a monastery. The different monasteries and priories under the Clunaic system were able to have a systematized, a uniform liturgy, a uniform set of a way of understanding the Benedictine rule, and also a shared form of government, so that reform could be spread not only in the one abbey at Cluny, but also all around the different monasteries that belonged to the Clunaic order. And that order spread from out to the Netherlands, Italy, Spain, England, and even up into Germany. And so these different monasteries were able to be clumped together in the Clunaic order. And by the year 1100, there were some 2,000 abbeys, priories, and cells of monks and nuns who were all part of the Clunaic order. This is why Cluny became such a powerful force in the church, because they had a systematized and an organized method of government amongst themselves. Also, they became fantastically wealthy with all these different monasteries and priories out there. And you see, this was 1100. So this is the beginning of the 12th century when they had that much power. And it was the 12th century, you remember in the last episode, where the monks began to come in and become popes and have more and more influence in the curia and in the governance of the church. And therefore, they brought that same sense of systematization and order into the reform of the church, so that the papacy, the church itself, could organize itself to cover all of Europe in an effective and an efficient way. The abbots did so through different abbeys and convents and priories. The bishops, the pope and the bishops, did so through the organization of course, dioceses and parishes. But it was really about this time period that this whole system that we take for granted came about. And it came about because of the Clunaic reform in the church, which was in the 10th and then most importantly in the 11th century. The Cluniac reform also consisted of a reform of the monasticism itself. They kept to a moderate asceticism, nothing too extreme, but there was silence in the monastery. The liturgy was beautified, and the churches were beautified, and along with the great lands they held, the churches were built beautifully, and the monasteries and parish churches also were well built, and it's a great flowering of monastic architecture during this time period. Indeed, the church at Cluny was at that time the largest church in the world because of its wealth and its grandeur. And so what happened was that as a result of this, of course, the monks of Cluny also began to be fairly wealthy, because they had so much wealth flowing in from all the lands they held, and of course, if you're living simply and you have a large income, it's not long before you're very wealthy, because you have more coming in than you have going out. And so it was with the monks of Cluny, and that's why, really, by the beginning of the 12th century, around 1100, there were some further reform movements happening within monasticism. And so in 1098, Robert of Bolême in France moves to a desolate spot in the middle of France called Citeaux. And this monastery, which you can still visit, you can go to Citeaux in France and see the place where Robert of Molemme established a new monastery following the Benedictine order, but it was going to be much more strict. And these were the Cistercians. The English saint and mystic Stephen Harding, who died in 1134, was also exceptionally gifted as an administrator, but he was also a very deeply spiritual man and a wonderful monk. And he took things one step on after Robert of Molemme in the Cistercian reform of the Benedictine movement. Probably the most famous of the Cistercians was Bernard of Clairvaux. And Bernard was a part of that same reform movement. He came there with 22 of his 30 of his disciples, including some of his brothers, and they founded the next abbey within the Cistercian order, which was at Clairvaux, and he died in 1153. So again, in the 12th century, the Cistercian movement was one of the great reform movements within monasticism. Continuing to look for a moment at the different reform movements, movements were very successful. The Cistercians soon began to almost take the place of the importance of the monasteries at Cluny. They had moved into Italy by the mid-12th century, Germany, England, Spain, even in Ireland, Poland, and Hungary. And the Cistercians were known for going to very out-of-the-way places. They would get a bit of bog land, or a bit of land on the coast somewhere, a bit of land on a mountaintop, land which nobody else wanted. And they would go there, and through their hard work, they would drain the swamps, they would terrace the mountains, they would turn it into a profitable and a successful farmland. And where the farming was, new villages grew up, and it was a very success. The Cistercians were very successful, and of course, they then soon became very wealthy as well. Also, in the 12th century, there were some other monastic movements which were started up as part of this great reform. This is where the Premonstratensians, founded by St. Norbert, were started. He was a friend of St. Bernard of Clairvaux, but he began another religious order which were known as the Norbertines, or the Premonstratensians. Also, more of the monks were desiring to live as hermits. St. Romuald, in the early 11th century, took up residence in a mountainside in Italy called Camaldoli. And the Camaldoli's hermits were begun then. At the same century, in the 11th century, the Carthusians, St. Bruno, a native of Germany, settled in the mountains in the wilderness near Grenoble in France, and set up La Chartreuse, which is the beginning of the Carthusian order. The Carthusians push monasticism, Christian monasticism, to its extreme. They live in community, but they all have their own cell. They have a vegetarian diet. They have a very strict regime of silence, and they are perhaps the summit of Catholic monastic contemplative orders. So now we move into the 13th century, and all this is going on through the 11th and 12th century, but at the same time, socially, what we're seeing is that people are moving away from the countryside to the farms, and they're beginning to move into towns. The towns and cities are beginning to spring up, and therefore there's going to be some social changes within the church as well. But if we look now at the 13th century, the dominant person in the church in the 13th century, as far as leadership goes, must be Pope Innocent III. Pope Innocent takes the throne of Saint Peter right at the end of the 12th century. He's elected in 1198, and he will be on the throne of Saint Peter for about 18 years, dying in 1216. He was one of a series of lawyer popes. You might remember that in the 12th century, along with the administrative expansion of the church and the reform of the church, canon law was codified, and the church began dealing more and more in justice issues. People would come to them, and the local church courts, diocesan courts, became the court of appeal, not only for church matters, but also for civil matters. There wasn't much distinction between canon law and civil law. Indeed, Europe in its chaos didn't have a shared civil law, and so the canon law became the civil law of all of Europe as the church expanded her power. And Innocent III was one of those who grew up within that system in the 12th century and was a skilled lawyer, a very brilliant man. The historians tell us that he was small, handsome, and witty. He liked puns and ironic wordplay. And he was supremely self-confident. He said, "Others are called to the role of caring, but only Peter is raised to the fullness of power. Now, therefore, you see who is the servant who is set over the household, truly the vicar of Jesus Christ, the successor of Peter, the Christ of the Lord." He saw himself very much, therefore, as a monarch of a pope, and he threw himself into church reform. He was he wrote some devotional books, which remained very popular. Like most of the popes, though, his monarchical pretensions meant that he was going to clash with the secular power. And sure enough, the Emperor Henry VI had claimed Sicily for his son, the future Frederick II, and this, however, encroached on the Pope's lands, and the Pope had to rely more and more on trying to get his historic papal states back, which had been the power had been eroded away from him, and he attempted to do that and clashed, therefore, with the secular powers. Innocent, though, and we'll come back in a moment to his involvement in politics, but Innocent is known mostly for his practical and pastoral reform. He's the one who called the Fourth Lateran Council, which met in 1215. And the council tackled an enormous range of issues, all of them practical, but also concerned with theological orthodoxy. There, the doctrine of transubstantiation was set down, regulations requiring Christians to go to confession and communion once a year, improvements in record keeping in the church courts, a tidying up and easing the laws about marriage and so forth. And the Fourth Lateran Council was therefore a very important milestone right at the end of Innocent III's very influential and very important papacy. One of the things that he was very concerned with was religious orthodoxy. And that's because with this increased reform and fervor in the church, at the end of the 11th, 12th century, and now into the 13th, we are seeing various different movements grow up of the laity. While the church and sometimes the monks also were decadent and corrupt, the lay people were increasingly fervent in their faith. And when this happens sometimes, different movements crop up, which then can stray off into heterodoxy and heresy, because they don't have the guidance and the teaching of the church as they should. We've seen this in our own lifetime with the new ecclesial movements. the neo-catechumenal way and the Legionaries of Christ and Opus Dei and some of these other movements have sprung up from the grassroots, and they're full of fervent lay people. But some of them, like the more extreme versions of the charismatic movement some of the ones that went off into little sects, tended to fall into some problems either in pastoral practice or in heresy because they cut themselves off from the church in a certain way. And Innocent was concerned about this. And one of the major heresies that had sprung up was the Cathars, or otherwise known as the Albigensians. The Albigensians were a kind of lay religious order, and they were influenced by a kind of dualism in their theology, in which the flesh and sexuality and food and so forth was considered to be sinful. So they had a way of life in which some of them were very ascetical and cutting off all physical pleasures remained celibate. But then some of them also went to the other extreme, as always happens in Gnosticism, saying that if the physical doesn't matter, then we can do whatever we want. And so there was also widespread licentiousness and lewdness and sexual misbehavior, as well as the extreme asceticism. And so this heresy was troubling most of southern France, and it was spreading. And so Innocent sent out some missionaries. First, he sent Cistercian preachers from the Cistercian monasteries to go and try to convert the Albigensians. But they arrived in somewhat in grandeur with nice horses and beautiful clothing, and tried to preach to these Albigensians who were living like Amish people up in the hills, you know, and were very austere. And they weren't impressed by the opulence of the Cistercian missionaries. So this is where an Innocent instead sends the preachers from a new fervent group who were following the Spaniard Dominic Guzman. The followers of Dominic would, of course, one day become the Dominicans, the order of preachers. And they were skilled in theological debate, but they also lived like poor people. Like the Franciscans, they were mendicants. They were begging for their food as they went around, and they were impressed. They impressed the Cathars much more, but they were unsuccessful in their attempts to convert the Cathars. And this is where Innocent decided to use force. And so he sends a mission to the Cathars in 1208, and he encouraged the crusade against the Albigensians, which climaxed in the terrible massacre, which is now so famous, of the Cathar town of Béziers in 1209. And his treatment, therefore, of the Albigensians goes down as barbaric and cruel. But we can't judge that time period according to the standards of our own age. It was considered a natural thing for a pope to call a crusade to go and deliver the Holy Lands from the Muslims and to use military might and military force. And so Innocent felt that he ought to do the same with the Albigensians. And finally, the cruelty of the campaign was successful, and the Albigensians were killed off. But the other aspect about Innocent, which is interesting, is that he was not harsh against all of these new religious movements. Indeed, he was happy to welcome and to use the Dominicans to proclaim the gospel and to preach the good news. He was also aware that things were changing. People were moving into the cities and the towns, and these new religious orders did not live out in a monastery in the country, but they established their friaries in the individual towns and cities. And they were called the friars, and friars is just a word which means brothers. And of course, the other famous ones, in addition to St. Dominic, which spring up now in the 13th century, of course, the Franciscans. And St. Francis, as you know, you will know his story, that he was born into the town of Assisi. His father was a wealthy cloth merchant, and as a young man he wanted to go off to one of the local wars and be a romantic hero, but he was wounded and came back and was converted to the Lord and gave everything to the Lord standing innocent before the magistrate and before the bishop, and saying now God was his father and he would live in total poverty. So this eccentric and delightful, charismatic person, Francis, begins this radical movement of religious people, religious movement in the church. And Innocent III was happy to meet with Francis. And if you've ever seen the film Brother, Son, Sister, Moon, which is about the life of St. Francis, is a wonderful scene where he actually goes to the Vatican and he meets Pope Innocent III, which is played by the wonderful actor Alec Guinness. And one of the stories about Francis going to Rome to meet the Pope is that when he first met Francis, Pope Innocent said that he should go and play with the pigs where he belonged. And so Francis took him at his word. And when he came to meet Innocent the next day, he was covered in pig's dung. And the Pope wasn't too happy to see him on that occasion. Pope Innocent also launched the Fourth Crusade. And this is the one which was so disastrous, because the Crusaders who were setting out to deliver the Holy Land from the Muslims got waylaid, and they ended up in Constantinople, and they were persuaded to invade Constantinople instead for political reasons. And they sacked the city, and there was a massacre. And you might remember that in the 11th century, 1054, the formal break between East and Western churches had solidified into mutual excommunications, but now in the beginning of the 13th century it was made worse, because the forces of the Western Church actually invaded Constantinople. The crusading forces sacked it, there was a massacre, and they also tried to forcibly convert their Eastern brothers to loyalty to Rome. And it was a huge disaster, and one which is still remembered by our Christian brothers in the East as this great grievance against them. All of this happens in the 13th century, and during the reign of Innocent III. Innocent III, by the way, also was involved in politics in Norway and Sweden, Bohemia and Hungary. He interfered and got involved in who was going to be king and who was going to be elected the king and who was going to succeed to the throne. And most famously, he was also involved with King John in England over the affair of the Magna Carta. The barons had forced King John, who was a bad king, to sign the Magna Carta, which was a charter for their rights, and Innocent sided with the king against the barons and got involved in the politics of these various different countries. Well, after Innocent's death in 1216, a couple of other popes take on the throne of Peter. It's Honorius in 1216 to 1227, and then Gregory the Ninth from 1227 to 1241. Gregory the Ninth was actually a kinsman of Innocent III. He was one of Innocent III's nephews, so there was a family business going on there in the papacy. And Gregory the Ninth and Honorius formally established the Dominicans, and then Gregory actually canonized St. Francis just 2 years after the saint's death. So this is amazing for this to have happened. They continued also, Honorius and Gregory the Ninth, to codify the canon law and to expand the church's influence around Europe, both in judicial matters as well as in ecclesial matters. In addition to this, Honorius stepped up the missionary outreach to the Baltic region, and when this would be complete, we could say virtually all of Europe, therefore, had been Christian. This is the last big missionary push into the Baltics. Honorius and Gregory also our intent, like Innocent was, on establishing orthodoxy. And after the success, if you like to call it that, against the Albigensians, they begin to establish the Inquisition, with Dominicans leading the charge. This is where the Dominicans, a little pun on the word Dominican, comes in. Dominic, Dominic Canis, which is the Dogs of the Lord. And sometimes if you see a bit of Catholic artwork, you'll see St. Dominic, and there'll be a dog there with a torch in his mouth, maybe in a painting or a stained glass window. This is a sign that the Dominicans, the Dominic Canis, a pun for the Dogs of the Lord, are actually doing the Lord's work. But part of that work was also in the establishment of the Inquisition. And the Inquisition, at first, was simply a way to sniff out and to determine where the heretics were and to try to deal with them, usually with persuasion and apologetics. But eventually, of course, as we know and we'll see later, it moved into the use of force. There was a clash also, therefore, in this second half of the 13th century, but again, between the politics and the papacy. And it was at this time that we see the emperor, the political power, Frederick II, trying to take over and dominate the Italian peninsula. And we're going to come up to this a little bit later, but two different factions began to develop, the Ghibellines and the Guelphs. And the Guelphs and the Ghibellines were supporting, on one hand, the Guelphs were supporting the new movements of republicanism and democracy, and the Ghibellines were much more supporting the aristocracy and the status quo. And this is going to be important as we see how things develop a little bit later. One of the things which happened also in the second half of the 13th century is that the popes began to have lose some of their income through the loss of their land to the different secular rulers, and therefore they had to devise different ways of adding to their income. And one of those was, unfortunately, selling different offices, an abbacy here or a bishopric there. And the more offices that were sold, the more a tax would have to be paid to Rome, so that the Pope could keep the show on the road. And this began to develop into real resentment amongst the people and amongst the clergy. And this patronage, as they call it, was something which was a privilege which the popes accumulated to themselves. The popes also fell out with the people of Rome, and by this time, a good number of the popes were spending their time away from Rome at the papal palaces in Viterbo and Orvieto. Well, in the second half of the 13th century, there were 13 different popes. Most of them were fairly mediocre. Pope Gregory X was the best pope of that time period, and he established something which had not been done before. And that has to do with the election of the popes. You remember by now the cardinals are the ones who elect the pope, but because of all of the political quarrels in the second half of the 13th century, the elections for the papacy began to be more and more drawn out because of all the different rivalries. You had the Roman families trying to control things. You had the secular rulers in Italy. You had the secular rulers in England and France and Germany, all of whom had their candidates in the amongst the cardinals. And so when a papal election came up, there was a lot of bargaining and politicking going on to try to get their man elected. And therefore, the conclave would go on and on and on. And sometimes there was a gap of several years before they would actually elect a new pope. So, for instance, there were 3 years between the death of Clement IV in 1268 and the election of Gregory X in 1271. And so, in order to stop this, it was Gregory X who was elected finally, who said that the conclave had to meet behind locked doors. And within 10 days of a pope's death, they had to elect a new pope. And every day that they were in there, their food and their provisions would be reduced. And so you can imagine, with the plumbing of the 13th century and the food provision of the 13th century and no air conditioning in the 13th century, that these men, who were used to living in comfort, being locked up in the same room with no proper plumbing and a dwindling food supply, began to have some incentives for actually electing a new pope. And so it was during this time that the popes finally had to were locked away to make sure that their election would go through. Gregory X as we say, was the best pope in the second half of the 13th century. He tried to establish rapport with the Eastern Church again and try to mend the schism. He was unsuccessful. There was a few steps forward, but there were more steps backwards. That brings us about to the end of the 13th century, a century which has seen the reform which began in the monasteries really find its way right into the heart of the church and continue to build up the administrative structure of the church, the legal structures of the church, but also, more importantly, the spiritual structures of the church. And although the church stamped on the Albigensians, in the same century, they encouraged the Dominicans and the Franciscans. And so we see this balance in church life all the time, in which, by the guidance of the Holy Spirit, there's a purification in the church, even though it's painful, and there is a renewal in the church. And although that's exciting, sometimes it takes wrong turnings and it needs to be corrected. And we see the church like a great ship sailing, tacking one way and then tacking the other, tacking one way and then tacking the other in order to establish a straight course. And when we understand that this is the way the church works and the way God works in the church, we can subtly start perhaps being a little bit more even-handed with the things that are going on in the church in our day and realize that these same problems have always existed. The same problems have always existed of perhaps corruption at the top of the church, a papacy that goes wrong, a papacy that goes very, very wrong, monastic orders becoming corrupt and wealthy and indifferent, but new ones starting up, a new reform movement starting up. And so what we need to do in our own age is be aware that there may be corruption in the church. As I'm recording this, we're facing the corruption of Cardinal McCarrick, who's been disgraced because of revelations of sexual abuse, and we're finding that the bishops and the cardinals in the church are handling it badly, and are devastated by the news, but not quite sure what to do next. And there are different religious movements going on, and some of them are reform movements, some of them are drifting into heresy and into wrong teaching and immorality. This is the life of the church. This is the life of the church. And we continue to be Catholics. And some people have said, how can you be a Catholic when you know all this stuff about the church? And I come back and say, I'm a Catholic because that's where I find Jesus Christ. I'm a Catholic because he is there in the midst of it. And he's there in the midst of it in the person of the priest, in the person of the poor, in the community of believers, in the sacred scriptures, and in the sacraments, especially in the sacrament of the Eucharist. And so it's in this 13th century we see the church, again, moving forward in reform, making some mistakes, making some errors, battling against corruption and battling against heresy, but doing so with a good spirit and with a hearty spirit as it moves forward. Now, as we come to the end of this 13th century, we're going to find that these two or three centuries of reform are now starting. Also, the pendulum is going to swing back because the last pope of the 13th century is one of the more notorious of the popes, Boniface VIII. His name it was Benedict Gaetani, and we're going to begin the story of the 14th century with him when we come back for the 14th episode of Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. I thank you for listening. I'd like to remind you that over on my blog, there is a new podcast series which is called Stories of the Unexpected. In each one of these stories, I tell a real-life story of something miraculous or marvelous, something supernatural or strange, which took place to me, happened to me, or to friends or family, or perhaps some of the lives of the saints. And then I reflect on that remarkable story and what it actually means. This new podcast series is actually behind the wall, which is reserved for donor subscribers of my blog. I would love you to come to the blog and see if you can afford it to support these podcasts and support the blog by being a donor subscriber. It's just $8.95 a month. That's less than $2.25 a week or something like that. It helps to keep my blog ad-free. It also helps to get these podcasts out there to reach thousands of listeners and readers all over the world free of charge to help spread the gospel and strengthen our church. Once again, this is Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. Thank you for listening.